Web Show, everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman. And with me today is at Stuntbox, otherwise known as David Slate, the design director at ProPublica, formerly at Businessweek, Pearson, Ed, etc. Designer, editorialist, wonderful fella. Hi, David.
Hi, Jeffrey. It's good to be here.
Yeah, I noticed on your Twitter feed, which is, again, at Stuntbox, pinned to the top is a note that says, "It's 2017. We have a new at POTUS, and accountability journalism matters. I'm helping build a better platform for it at ProPublica." Have you gotten a lot of feedback on that? You're asking for new tools, site features, email you.
Yeah, actually, we have. That's been part of a campaign that we did here, thanks to our social folks, where we went around and sort of made cards for everybody, or social cards, you know, things to go on your Twitter account or your Facebook, identifying us as reporters or editors. I myself am a member of the senior editor group, and just identifying people, announcing like, hey, this is the new administration. Here's what we're doing, and here's how it matters to the work that we're doing at ProPublica. I suppose a bit of background there is probably useful for folks. We are a nonprofit investigative journalism newsroom that does stories in the public interest. So things that you would think of as sort of deep dive investigative journalism. So obviously a new presidential administration matters quite a bit to the work that we do.
Right. You're not only a public interest deep dive journalism paper, but you're also a finalist for two Peabody Awards. You've won tons of awards, including a Pulitzer for explanatory reporting last year, and a Pulitzer for national reporting, and a Pulitzer Prize in investigative reporting. That's just in the last few years. I think for those who don't, why does a newspaper have what's the difference between a newspaper and journalism in the public interest? Let's start there.
Okay. Well, so, you know, the rank and file newspaper would be everything up to including the sports scores, stock markets, the what's happening in a metro, and usually fairly quick paced and a little bit more tactical, even though there are national desks and things that take longer. For us doing investigative journalism, it usually means a long-term commitment, really getting inside an issue and really digging down into it, for lack of more specific terms. And also our reporting can take many, many months to put together. We do quick stuff as well, but it's not unusual for us to have stories that people work on for 6, 8, 12, 18 months on the longer end of things. When I first got to ProPublica, I think there was one story that had been in the works for something on the order of 2+ years. And because that's really expensive to do, that's the kind of reporting that has disappeared the most inside of major newsrooms. Investigative journalism is usually the first thing to go because it costs a lot of money to keep somebody on a single story for that long.
Who pays for it at ProPublica?
Donors and institutions. So being a nonprofit, we fundraise, and we've been fairly successful at it. The place started around 2007, 2008, and has consistently built up a fundraising base and a lot of interest from the public. And the awards certainly help. They sort of serve as a bit of a certification that what we're doing is of pretty high quality and getting good results.
Now, I run a design studio, and when I start a new project, I do competitive analysis of what are my client's competitors doing? And for a recent client, I found that the homepage and then the inside pages are often completely different in this category, not news category, different category, that often there was a lot of work done on brand, but only on the homepage. And then once you got inside, it was sell, sell, sell. You have a similar, although differently motivated, issue at ProPublica in that a lot of your deep dives are very readable, have very readable layouts that are unique, that are creative, that are inspiring, that often have original illustrations and photography, and look like a magazine, basically, which I know you work on those things. Mm-hmm. And then there's sort of a more formulaic, like not really much different from The Guardian, typical article and homepage layout. How do you decide who gets what and when will all this come together as one design? I know this obviously this was – things were like this before you got there and you've done a lot on design, I know. But
yep.
You must be working toward a single design, no?
You are correct. There's a lot of work happening right now. Just to break it down, so I've just been here now a couple of years, and I inherited, you know, a site, as you noted, probably about 8 years of work or so. There's three basic areas that I'm responsible for. One is just the daily nuts and bolts production of the site. So booking photographers, illustrators. You mentioned illustration. We've had a lot of success there. We just picked up another American Illustration Award the other day for some project work we commissioned. But getting those stories up on the site every day, and we're sort of in between Z. We do publish every day, usually multiple stories, but not so much, obviously, as like a New York Times or a Washington Post, but more than, you know, one thing every couple days. We're doing stuff every day and getting the producers to get that in the CMS and get it on the page. The second one is the thing that you noted, which we call enterprise editorial. So the big stories, we sort of jokingly refer to them as template busters here.
Right.
For which I've actually written a set of custom code tools that sort of help us break outside the CMS and apply custom design.
What Jason Santamaria did years ago in his WordPress blog.
Yeah, absolutely. We use a set of stuff based on Jekyll and Grunt. We've sort of cobbled together a set of tools that work pretty well. And there's actually like a little reset switch in our old CMS. You flip a couple switches and it turns off all the default style sheets and script injections and everything. And you get a raw text field that you can dump in any CSS, JavaScript, or markup that you need. And our own little code rig, we sort of have this boilerplate. I mentioned this Jekyll and Grunt thing. And we've been evolving it over time over the last 2 years and adding more tools to it and making it more automated and a little bit slicker. Rob Weichert, who is here, has been here about a year and a half, is building in some new tools in there, including a grid system and a couple other things that we're really going to find quite useful for that.
Very talented guy also.
Yes, absolutely delighted to have him here amongst the rest of the team. We're doing some pretty good stuff, and I think that folks are going to see some interesting results of that probably in the next 2 to 3 months.
Help me find. I'd like to share the URL or two of stories like that.
So one that would be a really recent example, I think it's actually this week, just off of our homepage, there's this story, this minority neighborhoods pay higher car insurance premiums than white areas.
Wow.
So if you tap on that, that is a heck of a story. It's Julia Angwin, Jeff Larson, and Surya Matsu, who are three reporters here. Now, this I would
They're really doing this, by the way.
This is actually happening.
This is actually happening in America. Like, I know, I'm not supposed to be surprised anymore, but.
Yeah, for those listening along, the upshot of the story is we did a very deep dive data analysis. You know, people have always said anecdotally that I think, you know, my historically, economically downtrodden or minority neighborhood gets charged more for car insurance than the white neighborhood next to me. And the insurance companies have always responded, well, that's because there's increased risk in those areas. And when you look at the data, which we got access to in several states and spent a lot of time with analyzing, it actually turns out that's not the case. When you take a minority neighborhood that actually has less risk, they're still paying more. And further to the point, the white neighborhood is actually paying less than they should be. So we actually did the math, and it turns out that this is actually happening. So for us, editorially, you know, I'm in a senior editor meeting. We know that this is a significant bit of national reporting. We've taken a problematic trend. We've broken the issue down. We've proved it to the best of our ability. And we want to make a statement that this is a major story. We think that this is something that is a wrong that should be righted. You know, we optimize for impact here. We want to see laws change that will fix this situation or improve it. So that, to me, translates directly into a design decision of I've got to apply some custom design to it. This probably isn't necessarily one of our fanciest ones, but this is a really good example of one that, you know, just comes straight out of our rig where we were able to pull this story layout together in less than, I'd say, 2 working days, less than that, really, when it really came down to do the code work. You know, we had commissioned our photography, we commissioned some graphics for it, and just fired up a boilerplate rig, got stuff together, and hit this reset switch in our CMS, and we're off to the races with a pretty good foundation to build a great mobile-first layout, since that's how we code everything in this rig. It's where we've spent the most amount of time thus far because we sort of see ourselves a little bit, it's like music, we're in the hits business.
Okay.
After the election, more and more people are coming directly to our homepage. There's a lot of interest. Obviously, politics are on everybody's mind, and we do a lot with that.
More than ever.
Yeah.
Even more than during the Iraq War, it seems.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But we're under no illusions that, like, we're necessarily there's a small cadre of journalists and you know, smart folks who would come to our site every day. But for the most part, we know that people are going to be encountering us through, like, the dozen, 18 or more really major stories that we do every year. That's where they're going to bump into ProPublica. They're going to bump into it on Facebook when this thing gets promoted. They're going to land on this story. Maybe they'll surf around the main site a little bit, but we know that this is what they're going to find, and we want to grab their attention and get them into the story, have a good reading experience, feel outrage when they should feel outrage, feel empathy when they should feel empathy, and respond to these stories. So we started by spending a lot of time on these when I first got here because this was the where can you have the most punch, the most impact as a design director, the fastest, and it was this is the place. Now, there's a third area that I'm responsible for, which kind of speaks to your original question, which we're doing a lot of work on right now, which is the overall editorial experience and UX of the site.
The platform.
Yeah. So your question was, what about the rest of the site, the Workaday articles, which are, you know, to many degrees, no less important. There's the stuff we do every day.
Right.
And how do we get them to speak to each other?
On today's homepage, U.S. Immigration Agency will lose millions because it can't process visas fast enough. That's an important article.
Yep.
And it's clearly presented as an important article, but it doesn't get the same, you know, treatment as okay, so
it doesn't have a bespoke art direction on it.
Right. Well said.
And also, we know that there's a lot of optimizations we need to do. So we are literally in the process of moving to a new CMS, the first ever. I'm actually heading up that project, and we are overhauling our front-end code from top to bottom right now. And in a few short months, there'll be fundamentally the same overall information architecture. I don't know if the people still use the term IA anymore.
Yes, we do. Not many, but we should. And yeah. I had a member of the Information Architecture Institute on here a few weeks back, a wonderful speaker. And she reminded us why. Yeah, hell yeah.
Yeah, I enthusiastically endorse that. I think it's still something that it matters and it is a unique enough thing. Apart from that, so there will be that fundamental structure of the site will be the same, but we will be rebasing it. It'll be entirely mobile first, overhauled and a completely new front end code, new CMS, which is a pretty massive undertaking for a shop our size.
How many designers? Just two?
Right now, there's myself, there's Rob, and the rest of the team is about 4 people, including producers who occasionally pitch in on design stuff. And we are growing. We're going to be adding some more folks, hopefully sooner rather than later, as soon as I can find some nice folks. So if there's anybody listening who'd be interested in working on editorial design, hit me up. You can find my email address all over the site. We publish all our emails. But when we get out of the other side, there will be a mobile-first site with some smart design touches to it, and then that will form the foundation for what I'm going to think of as an ongoing set of optimizations to the site. We're studiously avoiding the redesign word. It's not going to be a redesign. It's going to be a rebasing so that we have a good platform for doing quick, nimble things with our regular articles and getting the art direction to match those big stories and make them closer and closer.
You just said redesign versus rebasing. I've never heard that before. So what's a rebasing?
I think for lack of a better term, I'm sort of just making this up off the top of my head.
Okay.
I would say, you know, it's a reset, basically. We're not going to pause there for a second.
Platform. It's a platform.
Yeah. We're building ourselves a better place to do design work going forward. Right now, there's you have a 10-year-old site, you get a lot of cruft, you get a lot of things that you need to do away with. A trip through the CMS is like an archaeological dig. You can see all the various like micro eras of this is when we did this thing for a year, this is when we did that thing. And the way that Scott Klein, who's my colleague on the data news apps team here, refers to it as we are paying down a massive amount of technical debt, which is just what accrues over time, which is going to make us a lot faster. And we're going
to faster for the user in terms of performance or faster to get stuff done?
Both, actually.
I knew you were going to say that. Damn it.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, if I do my job right, that's what we come out with. And we know that there's a lot of stuff we can do on the front end to make the site a lot more performant, both in terms of technical performance, like how fast does the JavaScript load, how fast does the CSS render, but also in terms of perceived performance. You know, there's a lot of stuff that the folks at Google and Chrome pay attention to in terms of like, what can you do to make images appear to be loading faster? What can you do to make the site feel snappier, even if you haven't made it physically actually faster? You can, a smart designer can do stuff to make it feel faster. This is a really simple example would be like, you know, you go onto Facebook and there are fixed placeholders for images and like little zebra stripes for text, which is speeding up your perception of how the site is loading. So little tricks like that.
Sure.
And then on the back end for our producers.
Pinterest does that. Pinterest does the blur.
Yeah,
and I just linked to an article the other day about that.
You know,
basically, which I got from I think Una Kravitz, but it's just it's this, make it seem like something's happening before it's happening.
Yeah, there's a reason when you in days of old you open a Mac and you wake it up from sleep and you're actually looking at a screen for a split second. That's actually that's fake. That is a screenshot of what it was before you closed your laptop lid. Just to make it feel snappier while the computer is coming back. I don't know if they still do that in current OS X, but that was one of the first OS X tricks.
They did that on the iPhone as well.
Yeah, how to make it feel faster. So we're thinking about that.
And you know the research is that perceived faster is better than actually faster.
So absolutely.
If you can make it feel, if it actually takes 3 more seconds to load, but something's happening all in, after a second and a half, you're better off than if it takes 2 seconds to load.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sort of fits into my own sort of mindset of how to do design. There's a whole debate about like, should designers code, should they not? And I try not to think of it that way. I myself am a designer who codes, obviously. A lot of the code we're going in the site right now, I do hands-on with folks like Rob and Hannah Birch and Jillian Kumagai, who are the rest of our staffers here on the team. But I always viewed learning to code as a means towards an end. I enjoy it, but I don't actually like it in sort of that philosophical sense of like, it's a thing I have to learn to achieve the end that I most want. And what I want is a site that's fast, snappy, readable.
You don't do it for pleasure.
At this point I do, because I actually have come to enjoy like some of the poetry bits of it, but I still see that in some science fiction future in 20 years, it could be that you don't code anymore. You use like their electronic blocks that you stick together.
Like PostScript.
Exactly.
At one time, for listeners who don't know, people had to actually hand code the PostScript to make a page layout on a computer. And we don't have to do that anymore.
And I view that stuff as that's our paintbrush. You know, those are our charcoals. That's our paper. That's how we achieve the end vision, which is far more important than what goes into doing it. Now, all that stuff along the way becomes incredibly important. It's where we spend, as designers and web folks like yourself, spend 95% of our lives. That's the back of house. That's like, anyone who runs a restaurant, all you see is the kitchen most of the time.
Right.
But all that really matters is the meal that shows up on the table for the patrons. And that's what, that's what most of us got into the business for as designers. You see something.
Yeah.
Something beautiful, you want to make it. So that's a bit of a tangent, but that's what informs my own sense of it.
People always make that mistake, though. I remember during the Web Standards Project, early days when we were fighting to get standards in the browsers and get people to use them, people would say, my users don't care if my site validates or whatever. And I'd be like, no, yeah, of course they don't. They don't know to care about that. But if it doesn't load properly because you forgot to close a tag, they would care about that. You know, it's, exactly. It's like,
yeah,
people get very literal about. I wanted to comment a little while ago. Mm-hmm. You were talking about the sort of disappearance of IA from our vocabulary. And here's my theory. You ready?
Yep.
IA comes from a world where someone goes to the front page of your website, which they may be doing again at ProPublica, which they do at nytimes.com, which they do at washingtonpost.com. But most websites, people are either searching or they're following a tweet or a Facebook link. So in the day when social media provides most of our links and search provides the rest, the brand starts, you know, people aren't saying, I've got to go see what the LA Times is saying today, unless you live in LA. But basically, I'll go to LA Times because they just published an interesting article and someone shared it on Twitter. And I said, oh, I've got to read that, right? I think that's the difference. So IA sort of fatalistically, IA assumes that you're going to stick around and look at more stuff and that you've come here for a reason. And I think it's being discouraged now in our industry because people are fatalistically saying, yeah, my brand doesn't really matter. People are just coming for the content. They're just going to grab it one way or another anyway.
So is it that I'm sort of almost want to do a yes and on that. Is it that, or is it more that social networks and other things like that are more important? And in those contexts, you lose a huge component of presentational control. So it's like, it's not just IA. It would be even visual design and the rest of them that like, well, I can only do so much in Facebook Instant. I can still do stuff, but there isn't a lot for me to wireframe here. It's up to Twitter now. They've taken control. It's up to Google AMP. My options are much more limited.
You know, I already had a stomachache, and then you mentioned Google AMP.
Yeah.
Are you guys working with that?
We are. We're not on AMP just yet. I anticipate that at some point in the future we will be. We have a lot of trickier questions in some ways than most news organizations because of, you know, I mentioned Scott Klein and his News Apps team. Mm-hmm. They do a lot of heavy data graphics and visualizations, which are explicitly the kind of thing that is very difficult to translate into AMP land. We actually had a really good chat in the office. Jeremy Keith had stopped by on a visit on his way to a Google AMP conference. So we had a great conversation.
Which he attended under protest, I believe. No, yeah, I think he went there as like the loyal opposition.
Yeah, I give them credit because that's they invited him to be the conscientious objector. Okay, they invited people explicitly to say we need some cons as addition to all these pros. And the way that I view it, honestly, is I sort of view it the same way I view a lot of our custom designs, which is those are R&D labs for the main site. So a lot of what we're going to be doing with the main site is informed by technical tricks we learned. If AMP teaches a good number of newsrooms to optimize their main sites, it will have been worth it. If they just throw everything at AMP and they abandon their own sites, it will have been a disaster.
The way people have all abandoned their own blogs in favor of Medium, for example.
Yeah. I think somebody the name eludes me at the moment, and I'm going to apologize to
her. Good, because you're half my age. I love it when people half my age can't remember names. I go, okay, it's not just me. I'm not really turning senile. Everyone does this. Busy people do this. I'm not senile. I'm just busy.
I'm gonna chalk it up to under-caffeinated.
Under-caffeinated. I'm never there.
But there was somebody at that Google AMP conference at Google. I believe it was a Guardian staffer who pointed out that they have already made some of their pages faster than Google AMP pages. It's just that they're not hosted on Google CDN,
therefore they don't count.
Yeah. Yes. So we had a lot of interesting discussion here internally. Eventually we want to adopt it because we want to be present in places that are doing interesting work for publishing and journalism. And because we're a nonprofit, we can afford to do that. It's not like we're going to suddenly risk our entire advertising play by getting onto AMP. But we also, myself and other people, were pointing out, like, hey, if we take the time, we can make our own pages as fast or faster than this. I don't think that we could ever compete right. with Google's CDN. That's kind of the big trick of the whole thing.
Right.
But we know how to make pages load wicked fast if we are given if we prioritize for that as an organization, and every other newsroom can do exactly the same thing.
It's tricky because at the same time, in news, if it's not well branded, I mean, I believe I was part of that Pointer conference that you attended in in Florida, in St. Petersburg. I feel like if it's not branded and authoritative, you lose you're losing the last vestiges of I should go to my local paper, or I should go to WashingtonPost.com, I should go to The Guardian, I should go to ProPublica. I think if you don't have a strong brand, then you are just it. And I don't know how you. I think it becomes increasingly difficult to do journalism in the public interest, funded by donations, if you become sort of a faceless just provider of text. Not that you're in danger of doing that right now, but I just with Apple News and with Facebook and all this, I see some really big players coming in and taking away our playground is what I see. I'm very upset because I think that the internet was once a place for a lot of independent voices. And it's in a million different ways that's disappearing. In a million different ways, there's a few big winners, people with lots of money. And those big winners can also go away.
Yeah.
Right? There's AOL and Yahoo and Verizon and Oath. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was Cluster, but anyway.
Yeah.
But, and tomorrow that could all go away. So they could basically make a platform for all that content. And then tomorrow they'd say, and it's gone. I still, to this day, Flickr, I still use it because it's the fastest way to find anything that I photographed.
Oh, I love it. I still think it's, I've actually recently been going back and using it a little bit more. And
Me too. I don't share there anymore. I don't tell people, "Hey, go look at my Flickr photo," because I know that all these jaded hipsters aren't going to bother. Right? It's not on Instagram or whatever the kids are using now. But if I need, I need my pictures of the Chrysler Building, and there they all are, like instantly. And I cannot do that with any other database. I cannot do that in any Adobe product. I cannot do that in any Apple product. It's just there it is in Flickr.
Yeah, I think that they're a good test case of, nobody wants to go to a party where no one's at. I think it's a case of audience development. It's not that they have, in some ways, still a technically superior product.
Absolutely.
I'm curious about the homepage decisions that they've made in terms of, I wish that they wouldn't try to copy Instagram so much on the main homepage, because their individual like photo pages are fantastic. But I feel like they really fell off on a lot of opportunities to do audience development. And they're a really good test case of what happens when they didn't break many things. They didn't go backwards, but they didn't progress. And in like the really hyper aggressive Silicon Valley world, like to not be constantly advancing is to de facto backwards.
Right. So if the iPhone 3 came out and then there wasn't an iPhone 4 for 5 years, that's it. It's over.
Yeah.
But similarly, like I haven't redesigned a list apart for a while. I'm working on a redesign. I felt like it doesn't need a redesign. It works fine. It looks good. But then the problem is, it hasn't been redesigned. People stop reading. I don't mean to say that they've all stopped. I mean, some people, because it's not new and shiny anymore.
Yeah, that's the Mac Pro that was in the news yesterday, that Apple announced that they're working on a new one, which seems entirely in response to the idea that, like, well, it's still an awesome computer. It's a supercomputer in a trash can, and it's tiny.
Yeah.
But they haven't done much with it for a while, so everyone's complaining, oh, you know, they're going backwards. And no, they just haven't progressed relative to the rest of what's going on.
The Mac Pro or the MacBook Pro?
The Mac Pro, the sort of Death Star black metal cylinder for the quote-unquote pro market. Whatever.
You mean
that
for people who are doing, like, music production?
Yes.
Or yeah. Video production?
Yeah, I don't...
Well, probably photo production, because I love my IMAX, but man, if you're serious about it, even photography, you just run out of room right away.
Yeah. So it speaks to development of audience and voice. I think I do want to go back to, you mentioned branding and this pointer event that you, which I thought was really good. I actually, flattery aside, like, I really did enjoy your session, because it really highlighted.
Which I called in like this. I had a I was supposed to be there wearing a suit, being my charming in-person self, which, I mean, there is a reason you go there. There is a reason you go places. It's just different. And instead, I called in. I was like, oh, my God, I had crusty eyes. It was terrible. I was very sick. I had pneumonia. So
you did well for someone with pneumonia. I gotta say, you did well just for anybody. For the folks who are listening, it was Pointer is another nonprofit that does journalism research, and this was an event hosted by Roger Black, which is called the Digital News Design Challenge, was it called? And Mike Swartz from Upstatement presented, and some other folks, and it was about, like, how do we solve some of the challenges we're facing as news designers and editorial designers. And you spoke a lot about brand. And I think this year, there hasn't been as much conversation about that until very recently. I think that you sort of hit on something that no one else was really bringing at that point. Mike touched on it a little bit. And it really, that actually did open my eyes a little bit.
I talked to Roger a lot. I mean, Roger Black knows this better than anybody. And that was my, you know, especially after talking to him, that was my take. Like, you know, I read the Washington Post on my iPad every day because their iPad app is pretty fantastic. And I never read it on my browser, on my desktop, because I don't enjoy the presentation and I don't know why they're so disparate. I don't know why. Well, obviously, it's a different group, and I don't mean to put one group down. This is just my personal taste. Some people don't like the thing that I like. Some people don't like.
Yeah.
They say it looks too magazine-y or too USA Today, or they think it's too playful or something. I don't know. But for me, there's, you know, it's weird. When I want to actually find out what happened, I navigate through my New York Times app, because that's very quick, and I get everything. When I just want to it's the same stories too, which is odd, you know.
But, yeah. So the question then becomes, right, is it in the sort of the Facebook Instant, Google Amp, Apple News, and five other, like, how do you maintain brand?
If you don't have that brand. Sorry.
Uh-oh.
I'm coming.
Sure, no problem. This will make things interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm in Manhattan and you're in Brooklyn, and we're recording this via Skype. And occasionally in this building, to justify the enormous rents, they know that, you know, for public safety, but
to make sure nobody dies in a fire, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a little bit like saying the food won't poison anybody, you know, the bare minimum of,
they don't live. Really, but they don't, it's not really true. You know how these things are done. They're all done in this sort of, nobody's really paying attention. We're going through the motions here way. Like, if there was ever a fire, we're all going to die. Basically.
We have a similar experience in our Soho office, where we were doing a lot of drills, and recently, I think it was a week or two ago, had a for real fire alarm. And as a designer, it was fascinating because nobody knew what to do.
Right.
We had we had tons of drilling, tons of this is what we do. And we all just kind of gathered like, you know, sheep in the lobby. And just if something really bad's happening, we're all going to die because we haven't solved this problem.
That's fantastic.
It was fantastic. Total breakdown of who, what, when, where, you know, the fire phone malfunctions, the people distributing information aren't conveying it. People are dispersing. Some are using stairs. Some are hanging around. Some are going back to their desk. And you kind of look at it and go, man, there's about at least a half a dozen to three dozen design problems here that can be fixed. So
I think we both see the world in term as a series of design problems that people are remarkably bad at solving.
Oh God, yeah. I feel like it was one of your SVA classes a few years ago, or it might have even been Karen McGrain's, the IXDA program. And I was sitting in on a session, and I think one of the students asked about their like final thesis thing. You know, what if my idea? It was basically like, you know, what if my idea isn't original enough? What if I run out of ideas? And I think I almost jumped out of my chair. It was sort of a, are you kidding? Like, just walk out of this building and walk down the street and just look. Like, really, really look. And there are going to be design things, problems, and issues that will smack you in the face.
I'm doing a lot of air travel right now. I just got back from Seattle, where we did our Event Apart conference, and I'm getting ready to go to Chicago for a family thing. And, you know, it's amazing. The signage, experts have worked on it, and I'm sure that the big companies like Capgemini come in to consult on it. I'm sure some of the finest minds in the world work on this stuff, but it's still like, you know, you're walking along in a strange airport and it says like gates A and B and gates A and B and tram and or gates A and B and baggage claim. And you're going, you just arrived, you're going to get your bag. And all of a sudden it just says A and B. So you backtrack, or it says train and then it says baggage claim, and you get on the train, and then I got on a train yesterday, and it as I was pulling out, it said like the next station would be the terminal, which would have been the wrong way to go. But in fact, I don't know. Anyway,
by far is the I remember this. You know, of course, designers, we encounter this all the time. But the Brooklyn DMV a couple years back, near Atlantic Terminal. For those who are familiar with it. I just sort of stood there and I was gobsmacked. It isn't often that I'll stand in front of something that looks like a design problem and just literally just open mouth.
Well, the DMV I believe the idea of it is to discourage people from driving. I know that I've given up. I don't have a license. I can't. You stand in line all day, and then someone who still lives with his mother says, and is like 45, says, wrong form, and then that's it. That actually happened to me.
Yeah,
Wrong form. Throws it back at me, and I go, and I'm supposed to leave.
I think
doesn't tell me what he needs. Just
yeah. For me, it's just looking at it and going like. So the first thing that you see is, as a designer, is like, well, it doesn't have to be this way. And then like you immediately follow that with like, I can fix this, which is what leads to like the unsolicited redesign. Like I don't know everything that went into this. And then the next phase of like, this is. You know, the longer I spend as a design director, the more I realize that like the two tricks are, you know, making a design and planning the rollout of it that actually accounts for the people who are going to do it. Meaning like the bureaucracy, if there's a bureaucracy, the pragmatic nuts and bolts of like how to get this thing from your vision to that, and B, how to get a team of totally different people to work on a design so that it seems as if it speaks with a single voice. And that speaks to brand too, I think, which is how to make, you know, when an Apple design like really, really works, everyone talks about or used to talk about Steve Jobs or used to talk about like Johnny Ive, when really there are hundreds of people who made any single thing, but it looks like a singular coherent vision spoke to it. And I think news needs to think about that as well. Your note about branding, which is like, well, you know, I'm on AMP, I'm on Facebook Instant. Like, I have an opportunity for colors, logos, typography, but I also have an opportunity for, like, how we actually write, how we write heads and decks, headlines, subheadings, how we write stories. And they should all work as one singular thing so that you could not mistake a ProPublica story for anything other than, well, of course, that's a ProPublica story. That's what we want people to think at the end, of course, that's a Times story. Like, how would it be anything other than that?
Well, Times does these very neutral headlines, no matter what.
Yeah. And
no matter what.
That's where it gets tricky.
Earth boiling over, all life perishing, Republicans, Democrats disagree as to why. That's a terrible example, but you know what I'm saying? No matter what's going on, they write these very bland. I hate, like, if it's late at night and you see, oh, Don Rickles died, and you hit the thing. Yep. But if you just hit the tweet, it's going to, depending on how you, I'd like to write my own tweets. If you don't, you're stuck with that headline. And it just feels kind of lackluster, like, you know, insult funny man perishes or something. I don't know. Just like, yeah, that's not really Rickles. That's not really the vibe. Well, that's fascinating, though, the idea that you could embed your brand. Of course, you embed your brand in tone and manner in how you write as well. But I think of that in terms of body copy, in terms of navigational content and so on. But actually, how your publication writes its headlines versus the LA Times Examiner versus the Washington Post, or for that matter, the Washington Times. That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, and I think that one of the training exercises in that is, like, you can start by looking at the places that sort of turn their voice up to like 11. Like, look at the extreme examples to start and work your way backwards. Look at like the Gawkers of the world when Gawker was a thing, and like, you know, we can't do that because there's prejudice and bias built into that. But like, look at those and go, oh, I can identify the voice there.
I used to write all the decks for A List Apart years ago, and they had a certain flip. I don't know. It was like somebody's talking about web design and development, but they read a lot of Mad Magazine as a kid. And they remember Steve, the guy from Marvel Comics. There's Steve Ditko and Smile and Stan. The way Smile and Stan would write these little, asides. I don't know. Pretty good. Then, you can actually see the influences.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm more and more, it sounds like an obvious point to make, but I think it's one that gets lost quite a bit, which is brand is captured in all of those things. And if they don't fit together, it doesn't work.
So you can survive AMP or Medium. For example, if you're reposting everything in Medium, to some extent with visuals, but even more so by the tone of voice.
Absolutely.
Right. Oscar Wilde would not have had a problem.
This is a thing that everybody struggles with. I mean, and the challenge for us in journalism, a shop like ours, which is, nonpartisan and does very tricky journalism, is how to try to do it without, like, it's easy to do it with bias, like, dumbass so and so does the following. It's like, well, that's way too prejudicial. How do we find a way to be sharp and pointed? Even the headline I'm looking at right now leading the site is a slightly sharper version of a headline that you could write any other way, which is, U.S. Immigration Agency will lose millions because it can't process visas fast enough.
Well, you guys are like, if no one reads anything else, I still want them to get the story.
Yeah, exactly.
Minority neighborhoods pay higher car insurance premiums than white areas with the same risk.
Yeah, and if you're really...
Okay, so here's the thing. People comment instantly on everything and anything controversial, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have right-wing and left-wing people immediately, doing their talking points. And so, if you wait and mention white areas with the same risk only in the body copy... then someone who only reads the headline will say, well, you're an idiot and don't know how insurance companies work. And in fact, someone on your site did exactly that. So even when you put it in the headline, then it's like, well, he only read the first 7 words of the headline.
Yep.
Right? Because, and it just.
And she is, and actually, as we speak, she is hovering outside the podcast studio right now. So I think she's the next booking to come in here.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. She, the person who wrote that. That article?
Julie Angwin is the lead reporter on that story, or senior reporter, and a wonderful colleague, and just did amazing work on this.
Yeah, but you still got to keep her out of that podcast studio. And while you're doing that and fighting for your space on the podcast studio, we're going to take a quick commercial break. Hello, I'm going to talk to you about Hotjar, okay? Good. So today most sites are built and improved based on hunches and guesses, but maybe we don't need to guess anymore. Now, all of us, most of us use analytics. If you're not a web professional, or even if you are, even analytics are still a lot of guesswork involved. Analytics are only as good as the person looking at them, right? And it's really important to know what people are actually doing. A lot of times we have situations where we have five stakeholders, and that's how you end up with a carousel on the homepage, right? And maybe nobody uses the carousel. If you could actually see how people use your site and realize that nobody's clicking on the carousel, you can go, you know what? The next time they ask you for a carousel, or they say it's time to refresh the carousel, you can say, you know what, Bob, Sally, that carousel's not working for us so well. Look, here's the data. So data is great for proving that you're wrong. Data is great for proving that you're right. It's good for confirming what your gut tells you. It's good for building consensus. It's good for finding out what's realistic. Data is hard to capture and data is hard to understand, but not with Hotjar. You can tell from the cute, friendly name, Hotjar is actually very accessible, right? It's a very accessible analytics and explanation all in one. So now instead of guessing what your users are doing, you can see which parts of the site that they love, where they click, tap, what they look at, how far they scroll, what they ignore. And you can play videos of your visitors, and it's like you're watching their eyes. This is kind of weird, but it's like you're watching over their shoulder as their eyes scan the page. You can also ask questions directly to your visitors and optimize your site for quick and effective results, and to make sure that the most important content is prioritized. Hotjar's range of features gives you access to solid proof about your user behavior. So stop guessing. Visit hotjar.com/bigwebshow. In fact, if you visit hotjar.com/bigwebshow right now, you will get a 30-day extended free business trial of Hotjar and all its functionality. Right? Why listen to me? Why listen to them? Try it out and see if it works. Even if you have no intention of buying, it's a 30-day free trial. So go there, check it out, and see if people are, in fact, clicking on that carousel. See if they are reading below the 17 folds. See if they are scrolling. See if they're clicking the big button that you want them to click. Find out what they're doing. Hotjar. Hotjar.com/bigwebshow for 30-day free business trial. Check it out. Hotjar, all-in-one analytics and feedback, hotjar.com/bigwebshow. Thank you, Hotjar, and thank you, David. We're back with David Slate. So, David, how do you work with editorial team and get their buy-in on things you need to do as an editorial designer?
It's pretty organic. The way that they created the position here, I'm actually the first design director that ProPublica has ever had. When I joined a couple of years ago, we created the spot as part of the senior editor group. So I worked side by side with the other people who we think of as sort of words or text editors, and also Scott Klein, who does sort of the data editing and the social engagement editor. And it's fairly organic. We know about stories as they're being put together and when they're being created, and actually sort of pitch our own from time to time. And so we are being there from the start makes it a lot easier to suggest, hey, you know, maybe we can capture this visually as opposed to the written word. Here's the kind of photography that we should be doing right now. Or here's a way to think about how you would approach this as a reporter so that we can capture it graphically or whatever we want to do. So there's less of it that's sketched out here. We do take a little bit of point and pride in being a little bit more bespoke than the average newsroom. So it really, really hinges on us being in very close contact with each other as much as possible through the whole process.
Now, what do you mean by being more bespoke than the average newsroom?
I think every newsroom sort of takes a little bit of point and pride, likes to think of themselves as being really unique. But I do think given our nonprofit background and our level of success and the kind of stories we do, that we are.
You're not gonna trim an article to fit an ad in or something like that.
Oh no, there is a running gag that's sort of a thing that we use here, that if ProPublica is a unit of measure, that means 5,000 words or more. Which, for those who aren't familiar, that's a lot of stuff. We generally, you know, our stories are big, and we usually go long on some of the bigger ones. It's not to say that we don't do short stuff as well, but one of the first big packages we did when I got here was this report by T. Christian Miller called Firestone and the Warlord, and it was about Firestone, the tire and rubber company, and, you know, they're a little bit complicit in the rise of Charles Taylor in Liberia in the 90s, which, for those that don't know, is one of the world's true war criminals. He's actually one of the few people who's ever been actually prosecuted and convicted for committing crimes against humanity. So to have a U.S. company sort of helping supply that is a big deal. That story was over 20,000 words. That's literally a novella-length news story. So there were a lot of design challenges in how to approach that and present it, but that is something that's unique to us. We do not shy away from presenting a lot of content.
And how do you collaborate with, because I know you do at times, this, you'll do a longer article in cooperation with another news organization. How does that work? And how does, specifically design-wise, how does that work?
Yeah, that's actually another thing that's really unique to us, is that right from the start, part of the strategy was that we were going to co-publish with other places. So that literally means that we will publish the same story at the same time, and we will often, in many cases, actually help co-report it. So this works out really, really well for both parties involved, in that, you know, we go to co-publish with the New York Times, or we report on it. So they get another reporter, which can be very expensive. Mm-hmm. And we get to publish our story on their site and vice versa. Now, I think we don't necessarily do it as much with design, but we have. And the one that was really successful for us, a little bit of a trigger warning, and that, like, you know, we report on fairly serious topics. Mm-hmm. But we won the Pulitzer last year for a story called An Unbelievable Story of Rape.
Yes.
With the Marshall Project, which is a criminal justice nonprofit, which is actually somewhat like ourselves. And this story was about a rape victim who had gone to the police and had been pressured and eventually recanted and said that she had made the story up. But it turned out that wasn't true. And years later, police in another state found her attacker, found photographs of her. It turned out the story was true all along. And our two reporters, so Ken Armstrong at Marshall Project and T. Christian Miller, were actually out in the field reporting this story at the same time, didn't know it. They actually bumped into each other, like called the source, and he's like, well, I don't know why you're talking to me. This other guy I talked to. Now, what would normally happen at most newsrooms is we would run back to our desk and we would rush to get the story out before the other newsroom. But because we knew, you know, because of who we are, we called them up and said, hey, you know, you're working on this story. We're working on it. You know, you've got an awesome reporter. We've got an awesome reporter. Why don't we both do it together? And everyone said yes. And we took that a step further with design for this one because, you know, Gabe Dance and Andy Rossbacher were working at the Marshall Project at the time, were two awesome design folks in news. And we said, hey, we've got a story rig. So we actually made a GitHub repository where we co-designed the story, worked with Lisa Iaboni on picking illustrators and photographers for it. And so we were checking in code. So they used the base of our rig. And Andy and I were coding on it together. And then, like, at the last step of the process, we both cloned the repository and we made some tweaks to it so the art direction would match our sites individually a little bit more. The Marshall Project version looks more like the Marshall Project site.
Right.
And the ProPublica one looks more like ProPublica. But we both got, you know, a really great story package out of it that's based on the same fundamental skeleton. And, you know, it was really successful. And that is actually also, furthermore, a really good example of design editing. So we made a decision pretty early on that, like, most newspapers, when they get two writers together, the first thing they're going to do is mash them together and sort of homogenize their writing style. Mm-hmm. So it's like one voice. And we sort of said, well, you know, why don't we use design? Like, why don't we do the opposite, which is Ken is reporting from one part of the story in one state and T is in the other, reporting on another aspect of it. So literally T is doing the police story in Colorado, like how mm-hmm. the cops found this guy, and Ken is talking to the victim in Washington State. Mm-hmm. And so why don't we use art, direction, and design to break the story up, and you will tell it in turn. So it's a physically broken narrative. As you go through it,
yep.
you read the first part in her voice with Ken writing it, then you switch over to, and you'll notice the art direction switches. When you're dealing with the victim, you're in the realm of illustration and impressionistic
yes. artwork.
And when you're dealing with the police, it's evidentiary photography. And so this allowed us to say, and the reporters loved it because they were already writing to each other, is how we sort of say it in the business, but they didn't have to go so deep as to like create one smushed together narrative where they disappeared into the writing. So it worked on every front. It was a dynamite story. It was absolutely heartrending. And a really great look at what, you know, when these types of investigations into sexual assault go very wrong and what the police can do better. It was a really great co-design thing, and it actually used design to enhance the editorial narrative without getting in the way of it.
Mm. It's wonderful. You do in mobile lose the one story set on the left and the other story sort of a column on the right. You do have.
Yeah.
Of necessity on a phone, you're going to lose that. But
yeah, depending on which version, there's like a little bit of color difference. There's a little bit of art direction breaks. Ooh. And that was certainly tricky. I don't necessarily think that we hit it on every point. It's still the one thing
This is a fantastic piece, David. I didn't mean to.
No. I take a great amount of pride and joy in the fact that I did product work with startups for many years too, but news stories, like, you know, you ship one and you're on to the next, and every single one I can see in the few years I've been here, I can look at the ones that we did at the beginning and the ones we're doing now and the growing sophistication as we're just learning with every trick. So something we didn't quite get right on mobile, like, it's not like, you know, working 18 months on a client site and you ship it and
then you go, oh dang.
Yeah. Exactly. It is. And, you know, some really good shops, I know, Jeffrey, you've done this too, is like, you know, sometimes if you're really lucky, you get to go back to the client. How did it work? What can we improve? Like, you have a good relationship, which is what we aspire to. But that's probably the minority of times. So we sort of, the antidote to that in news is like, well, there's always another story. So it's like, we have minimum viable product every day, every week. And so every chance that you get, like, if you see something in that story, you're like, you know, that didn't quite work. Next week, you're going to have another opportunity to do it better.
That is a fantastic place to end things, I think.
And scene.
That is great. I love this. I love the publication. I'm so glad you're connected to them. And Rob, you're really good people. And I think it's clear they picked the right design director.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what's next? What's next for ProPublica? Anything you can
Stay tuned. Bigger, more awesome, more impactful stories. A site that's probably going to start showing some new tricks and a couple tools that are probably going to come out of it that we're going to try to share with the world. So it's going to be a busy couple months, a busy year for us. And obviously on the reporting side, we're also busier than ever. So going to be a lot of stuff on pretty much every front.
Fantastic. David, thank you so much for taking time from your very busy day.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Great. And thanks, everybody. Thanks, Hotjar. And we'll see you on another Big Web Show. Bye-bye.